So I want to outline for you the approach to the 600 practice that I'll be taking over the next day. So I think the way we've been shown the practice by Bhante is the standard way, if you see what I mean. So I'm not trying to replace that, I'm trying to supplement that with another way of looking at the whole thing, which I found to be helpful, and I'll be interested to find out whether you find it to be helpful. So there are two elements to what one's trying to do in the 600 practice, or rather two approaches to the same thing that you're trying to do, which is fundamentally to break through ego clinging. The first is more analytic, in which you try to convince yourself that there cannot be anything that can be said to be I within the five and six elements. Sorry?
There's nothing that can be said that can be I.
Sorry, I didn't get it.
Yeah. Are you able to hear there?
I heard you. It's
no, I mean, are you in the right place to hear?
I think so, but I'm still tuning in.
Okay. So, yes, you're trying to look at the elements to see if there's anything there that could be the basis or could constitute I or mine. So I'll come back to how you do that in a while. You're also trying to let go. And, of course, the one is related to the other. Because there is nothing that you can cling on to as I truly, then you let go. Bhante said he doesn't think letting go is enough. It's a question of actively giving up, actively renouncing. So it has to be a conscious pushing away, giving up. That at least is so the first five elements. So I try to use both approaches. And I'll talk more about the analytic approach in a while. The other approach is more difficult to say much more about. It's simply a matter of trying very consciously to change your relationship to that element by giving it up, by actively thinking, this is not me, not mine, not myself. I want to look a little bit more at the analytic side of it. What are you actually looking for? I think this is something that we need to be clearer about. And there is in Abhidhamma analysis, especially again coming from the Mahayana traditions, and I think it even goes back into Savastivada again, a definition of Atman, which is the independent, fixed, unchanging self. And it has three characteristics, which are what you need to look for. So it has the characteristic of being impermanent. Of being permanent. It doesn't change. Yes, so you're looking for something that doesn't change. Not only doesn't change, as it were, moment by moment, but that hasn't ever changed and will not ever change. So you're looking for something that exists or is to be found within each of the elements that has always been, that is eternal. You could look for something that's more sort of short-term enduring as well, but that hardly constitutes a permanent self. That's merely a sort of temporary self, but you won't even find that. Okay, so that's the first thing. You're going to be looking to see whether there's anything that you can be confident has always existed, will it always exist, and so on. So you actively look for that. Now, we all know that you can't find that because we're good Buddhists and we're a bit educated. Modern scientific inquiry tells us this too. But it's important to actively look. Because you try to arrive at a point where you're more than intellectually convinced. You're convinced at a very deep level You know there cannot be such a thing. And you want that to be a recognition immediately before you. You can have a sort of a theory in your mind, there is nothing permanent. But this is different to that. It's actually being immediately convinced through your inquiry that there cannot be anything permanent. The second characteristic that you're looking for is something that is independent, that is exists from its own side, it's sometimes described. So it exists independent of all conditions and of your perception of it. So it exists, another way to put it, it's the author of itself. It's self-created, swayambhu in the Hindu terms. It emerges, as it were, from itself. Because if it's conditioned, it cannot be permanent, if you see what I mean. If it's permanent, it cannot be conditioned. So you're trying to find something that does not depend upon conditions. And you won't be able to find it again. And we know that to start with. But please try. Because if you don't really go looking for it, it only penetrates at this level. You've got to try to get it to go a bit deeper. And the third characteristic we're looking for is that it is single, is the way it's described. Single in the sense that it cannot be subdivided. It's unitary. It's, in a sense, you could say, solid. It can't be cut up into bits. Because if it can be cut up into bits, then which of those bits is the real self, if you see what I mean? So then you'd have to pursue the same inquiry into that. So the self must be something solid and unitary. It must be something that is independent of conditions, and it must be something that is permanent. If it's not, well then, in what sense can it be a self? If it's merely a sort of a passing phenomenon that arises and passes away, or if it's something that actually rests upon other things, or if it's something that is further subdividable, in what sense can that be a self? You could say it can be a self just for sort of conventional purposes, but that's not what we hold to. We hold to the background idea that there is something about us that is solid, permanent, and independent. So we go looking specifically for those three. That's what we're going to try to do for the next day or two, just to, as a variant on the usual way of practicing, just to try to push the inquiry a bit further. I'm advancing this partly because I found this extremely helpful myself, that it enables you to inquire a bit more closely. And partly because I think when you don't make a sufficiently penetrating inquiry just doesn't go very deep, and you end up with a sort of a superficial and slightly pro forma a dismissal of self. It needs to go deeper than that. So traditionally you do use analytic conceptual tools to look more deeply, at the same time as actually trying to actively let go, to give up, and to renounce. So I'll try to lead you through it in this way. You may not find it easy to relate to. Some will find it more interesting than others. Some will find it more difficult to concentrate. Then I suggest you sort of concentrate on the other side if you find the analytic side more difficult, so that you, you're more giving up, renouncing. But I think you'll find the two work together. I've been very interested in this because recently I've become interested in the Chö practice, and I got introduced to the practice. Because it is a highly imaginative version of the six element practice, because you actively dissociate yourself from your body. You eject your consciousness. into a Dakini, and then you see the Dakini cut your body up into pieces. And I think that's a third aspect, a third approach that I'm going to explore on my solitary retreat. So I think it could help to make the supplement the work on the other three sides, if you see what I mean, because the conceptual can so easily be merely be conceptual. The effort to just let go can be just sort of words you're telling yourself. So I'm interested to see how the imaginative dimension helps. Of course, there's also in that chö practice the idea of giving yourself away, because you're giving your body to other beings, so it has a sort of bodhicitta dimension to it. And that can be very helpful in the 600 practice. If you find that useful, you can sort of think, well, I'm giving up this attachment to myself for the benefit of others, so that I can work for the benefit of others. So I think it's quite good to import other angles of attack. But I do think the more analytic, conceptual approach needs to be part of it, so that you're really digging deeply into the substructure of your assumptions. There's another approach that I've found very, very useful, and I've discovered mainly through teaching people the 600 practice in India, where they think differently, and they tend to more easily dissociate the conceptual from the experiential. Interestingly, because in a way I always think of Westerners, and certainly English, as being much more capable of alienation. But in some ways, the Indians are much more able to sort of get really excited about a set of ideas, and then it just doesn't make a blind bit of difference. It's fate, the Westerners always come, they want to lead workshops, you know, on management or something like that. They love it, they love it, they love the games and all the rest of it. It just doesn't make any difference at all. I'm not sure that it does here either, but that's another question.
It's another view.
Probably. And they get very muddled up about the practice. Again, it's a different culture, so people receive things differently, certainly from somebody like me, from my culture. So what I've been stressing is mindfulness. And to me it seems that essentially the six-element practice is a mindfulness practice. And what you're doing is taking each of the dhatus, the elements, and I encourage people to become aware of the experienceable aspects of that dhatu. So that, for instance, the earth element experiences solidity, isn't it? It's energy in a solid condition. It's energy that resists. So you experience the resistance of earth element in you to the earth element in the seat. And you bring that into awareness. And you're trying to change your mode of awareness so that you relate to it differently. It's still there, and again, this is something I strongly stress, you're not trying to stop experiencing the earth element. You're trying to experience it, but without attachment. And so it's a shift takes place in your mindfulness, in your awareness. You feel, if you're successful in this, very free, very light. You notice it, but without being caught up with it. Most pertinent, of course, in where there's pain. I'm not advocating having some pain, because that'll take care of itself. But, you know, famously with pain awareness, you try simply to be aware of it without being tangled up in it, the famous second arrow. But it's the same with the sensation itself. You're aware of the sensation, but you remove that sensation from the contextualization, the view-laden context of it being mine. And I found myself that you can actually make a shift. Interestingly, the Buddha talks in the Pali Canon, the Majjhima Nikaya, he talks about consciousness being bound up with the other five elements. I can't remember what the Pali word is now. Bandhana. It's sort of tied up with. You identify consciousness with those elements. So if you can step back, as it were, stop identifying with the elements and see, or just be aware of them, stepping back from them does not mean denying their existence, doesn't mean becoming alienated. It means being aware of them in a different way, in a more spacious way, you could say, to try and create an image of it. You know, like the blue sky and whatever passes through the blue sky. So consciousness is more expansive, more detached. In effect, it's vast, so you're already beginning to move into the sixth element. You're beginning already to disentangle consciousness from that element. So I don't know whether these approaches help, and maybe different people will find different ones appeal. I'll try and sort of mention them all so that you can work with them all. The conceptual, which is a direct recognition that cannot be a permanent self. There just can't be. Because what a permanent self would have to be is, well, permanent, it would have to therefore be identifiable, experienceable as something permanent. It would have to be single, indivisible, and it would have to be independent of conditions, because if it's dependent on conditions, it's going to change. It'll fade when the conditions fade. So you really persuade yourself very deeply that this is the case. And my experience is that from time to time, when you're trying to do this, a sense of conviction arises. The sense of conviction sort of passes you beyond analysis. It becomes an experience. You're not merely intellectually convinced, so to speak, you're experientially convinced. I think this is what bhavanamaya prajna means. I think bhavanamaya prajna means that you've convinced yourself through listening and reflecting, and the conviction passes into a sort of wordless recognition. You know that experience sometimes when you're reading the Dhamma and you really see what it's saying is true, and you have to just stop there, because more words just won't go in. You're just sort of sailing with the experience. So you're trying to get to that point where you're just flowing with the experience that there cannot be a fixed and solid I. And then it goes. So you go back and you build it all up again until the point comes when you can stay in that conviction for a longer period of time. At the same time, you're, as it were, emotionally trying to detach yourself. And that detachment is an active one, consisting of renunciation. And I do this mentally, verbally, mentally, as it were. It's not me. I let go. I'm not attached to it. Really trying to almost forcibly sort of make myself leave it behind. And then trying to keep alive a sense that I'm doing this not just, you know, for my own satisfaction or for my own stream entry or something like that, but because this will make me a better human being and I'll be able to benefit others. So trying to connect with the bodhicitta dimension, which again takes one beyond the nihilistic element, which is the danger of these sort of practices. And then this working more in terms of detaching consciousness and changing my mode of being aware, so that it's there, but you're not bound up with it. A bit like watching clouds or something like that. You can't even really identify what the clouds are. Your mind wants to know it's a this or it's a that, but its form is ungraspable. And so you just sort of watch. I suppose aesthetic experience, you know, is of that kind, isn't it? Where you're not grasping at the aesthetic object, you're simply letting it be, but without sort of identifying with it in the sense of wanting to take it away from the gallery or wanting to learn to play it yourself or something. It's just pure appreciation. So it's mindfulness in that sense, a sort of pure appreciation of the sensation of the element, which because of the analysis is then representative of that element overall. So those are the attacks that I will introduce you to today. And we can see how they go, whether they work for you, what works best. Maybe leave it a couple of days to see, get a run at it. And I'll be interested to find out how you find the approach that I'm giving. I please ask you not to just go and immediately teach it like that. I think it's important people learn the conventional way, and then because that gives a background of the practice, and then one can experiment with different ways in guiding people in it. I'm doing it in this context because it shows us the deepest view, the view from which all other views come, as we'll find out. So in examining it in this retreat, I'm hoping that we will get both a better idea of what we're doing in the Six Element practice and a clearer idea of what views are and how they work. Yes, I might not introduce all those approaches today. I'll probably introduce the first two, first of all. But anyway, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I'll try not to talk all the time. When it comes to the sixth element, there's a real change of gear. Because by this time, you've disentangled consciousness. Consciousness has been disentangled from the, as it were, objective elements. The five elements, earth, water, fire, air and space, are all objects of consciousness. And you're persuading yourself that there's no self in anything that can be experienced. Do you see what I mean? Because whatever is a self, if you can discover it, it has to be an object of experience. Yes, which doesn't really quite make sense when you think about it, because what the owner of experience can't itself be an object of experience. And that's what you begin to reflect on when you get to the sixth element. You begin to reflect, well, I've let go of everything that I could possibly experience because I've seen there's nothing there that's I. All mine, by the way, I didn't touch on that. The definition of mine in the tradition is something that can be controlled by me, by my will. You see what I mean? You can't call something mine if you don't have control over it. Otherwise I could say it's my moon, which just doesn't make sense. I can't control the moon in any sense at all. Except by shutting my curtains or something like that, but the moon still continues to shine. So usually when one's doing an analytic, one would also add in, is there anything that you can control in a more than merely immediate sense? I can lift my finger, but it's not up to me whether that finger comes into existence and passes away, and I can't stop it from getting disease beyond a certain point, and so on. So, yes, you should, by the stage of the sixth element, have got to the point where you can, you've disentangled yourself from the five elements. You've recognised to a sufficiently strong degree that none of them are possible candidates for I or mine, by definition. You've convinced yourself pretty deeply, and so you're aware of them in a rather different way. They're now merely sort of neutral objects of your awareness rather than being bound up with your clinging and craving. And in a way, that should be enough. Once got to that point, Bhante says, of course, you do not let go of consciousness. And again, this is a struggle I've had in India, that people, you know, saying, I tried to let go of my consciousness, but I couldn't do it. Not surprising, because that would be the end. But the way Bhante puts it, it's not that you let go of consciousness, as you do with the others, you let go into consciousness. So you sort of relax into consciousness, recognizing that consciousness cannot belong to anything, because you've seen that there is nothing to for it to belong to, and it cannot be owned by anything, because you've seen there's nothing outside consciousness or objective to consciousness that can be a self and therefore an owner. And one may have to spend some time, I don't usually spend much time on this, recognizing that consciousness itself is not an object. It's not a thing, if you see what I mean. So it can't be an I. There's no such thing as consciousness. Consciousness is the act of being aware. And I'll try to remember to talk always about being aware or awareness rather than consciousness, because consciousness immediately connotes a thing. Actually, it doesn't any more than awareness, but somehow awareness brings us closer to the act of being aware. Consciousness, according to Abhidhamma tradition, and then of course this gets further expanded in later tradition, in Yogacara, and ultimately in Mahamudra and Dzogchen, is by definition formless, without colour, without shape. What is it in the Avalokiteshvara Sadhana?
Without beginning and end.
No, colour and shape, it's not. It's not. Huh? A form and colour, it's not. It's not.
And so of one and more, it's void.
But so one and more, it's void. In other words, one and more are to do with the objective world, because we make differentiations between things and we can say that's one and that's many. But you can't do that with consciousness. It's not of that kind, as it were. So you may have to spend some time doing that. I won't do that today. I'm more focus on recognizing that since there's nothing you can identify consciousness with, or that consciousness can be identified. No, wait a minute. I'm trying. There's nothing that can be the subject of consciousness, and there's nothing that can be possessed by consciousness. And that really there is just the act of awareness, a continuing act of awareness, which you can relax into and just rest in. But it only works really to the extent, I think, in my experience, and I'm talking to others too, to the extent that you've disentangled yourself from the five elements. To the extent that you've, in the five elements, worked at being aware of them, but without binding yourself to them. The sixth element is, in a certain sense, relatively easy. The main problem is just staying focused, as one tends to drift when one gets to that stage, in the delightful, fuzzy, warm glow of nothing in particular. So I hope I've rather briefly and swiftly gone over what art you're trying to do, just so that you're sort of understanding kind of where I'm trying to go. I'm not professing to have it all completely worked out, but I'm interested in getting some reflection back. And I'm sure you can already see how this impacts upon what we've been talking about with views. There was the best way I could think of getting to grips with views in meditation, apart from through our own sadness and so forth. So anything that I've said that requires unpacking further, or unclear, or doubtful?
So you just confirm that you could weave these three different approaches together in the same practice?
Oh, yes.
Rather than saying, for this session I'm going to use the analytical approach, or this time I'm going to use the
Generally, that's what I would do.
Right.
And I probably do that to some extent. I think you at least need to accompany the cognitive with the affective, if you see what I mean. You at least need to be making an analytic penetration as well as a sort of an active disentangling, which I would connect very much with the disentangling of consciousness, of awareness. That I, in my own practice now, I use that as my main model to carry the analytic. Do you see what I mean? The analytic is sort of needs to go somewhere. So if you're also trying to disentangle, and especially to change the way in which you're aware, I'll spend some time just experiencing the contact. You know, this is the solidest contact, the body on the chair or a cushion, and I'll just spend some time sort of almost playing with my awareness of it. But then the analytic gives that a sharper focus. So I think, you know, I'll lead you through it in my way, and I'm hoping to give you some tools that you can then use in your own way. And ideally one would sort of poke and prod according to need and taste. And probably one would need to spend a bit more time on the analytic just to make it really work. It's a bit hard to do if you're not... You need to keep your mind focused on it, if you see what I mean, which is not always that easy. But I think if you skip that, you can get some definite feeling of release, but I don't think it goes far enough and deep enough.
It's like stripping away all the distractions, in a way. Is it just getting back to the very core of it?
Yes, yeah.
In that sense. And it's because we can get caught up in the distractions and think we're getting there, but actually we're not.
Yeah.
So it's getting to the very nub of where our thought process is.
Yes.
It's undressing all of that dressed up stuff.
Yeah. And I think what often you will find if you do that, I'm preaching to the converted, I know everybody knows these things, but it's just a sort of unpacking of it. What I find is that there is, even though I've convinced myself, even though I've actively let go, even though I've changed my mindfulness, there's something deep down inside me which is saying, oh yeah, come on. We'll go along with it for the time being. It's that, of course, that you're trying to get down to. That's a little flavour of the Sahaja Klesha or Nyaya.
We're not quite prepared to go there.
Well, in a way, you don't know how to.
Yeah.
Because it's so much the substructure of your being.
Mm.
It's why we're here. It's what's brought us into this existence. And it's below the level of consciousness. And when it's threatened deeply, it really doesn't like it. Some of us know. I remember once at Pamaloka breaking up a knife fight between two order members.
Yeah.
They're the good old days. one of them going for another with a carving knife. It was a terrible noise. So I went in and shouted, you know, stop! And, you know, without thinking, they parted. And anyway, I went to see Bhante later, and it was terrible, isn't it? You know, that people behave like that, and so sort of aggressive, really awful. And Bhante just said to me, don't think you're not capable of that.
Was it one of your talks on the system of practice?
Oh, okay, yeah. I'm not surprised. It had a deep impact on me. But yes, and what I think he means is that self-clinging is, you know, when you, everybody's got their different level to which they can be pushed, but at some point it turns. And so you're deliberately trying to gently work your way down to it sort of loosen it. And of course, it's in the context of faith, of puja, of your sadhana, and so forth, all of which gives you a framework for containing that.
When I was doing this Kashavana, I found this practice really frightening. I was just so scared. And Padmasuri suggested that what I and anybody else could do was to, like, if you're going to focus on the water element, to first of all in your mind have images of waterfalls and to have beauty in one's mind when one did it?
Yes, you need something that arouses the department of faith, if you see what I mean, which would include imagination and aesthetic appreciation. So you need to have that sort of sense of enjoyment of faith, yes, of something more, because you know again it's the problem that we dealt with this morning of no view, that for some of us that has a nihilistic ring. So the practice itself has a nihilistic ring if you do not have a strong sense of I don't want to make it sound like people who don't find it easy don't have strong faith, but it needs to be employed in the practice, and I think that's what Padmasuri was suggesting to you, employing your aesthetic faculty and your enjoyment of nature and the soothing qualities of nature in order to make sure that the practice did not become a nihilistic practice, merely the elimination of I mean, in a sense, without a sense of what you are eliminating it for. In a way, I think a bit of fear is a bit inevitable, but one wants to take it in manageable doses, I suppose. So I think that if you do find fear arising, probably the answer is maybe something like that, but also something like bringing your yidam into the practice. And even, you know, asking them to protect you, to help you, getting a strong sense that you're doing it for that higher purpose and that there is something beyond this. You're doing it because actually this is stopping you from being really happy and really free. So you might have to work at that.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. I think that's the problem, isn't it? Some of us are more inclined to nihilism in for various reasons, all sorts of reasons. Call it nihilism, but and I don't think there's any grading as to which is good and which is bad. It's just difference of character. I've never had that problem particularly, and I don't think it's a great virtue that I haven't. It's just the way I'm constructed and cultural experience and so on. But you need to do these practices, or particularly analytic practices, in a strong context of faith. Mm. Again, it's why I invoked the Trikaya at the beginning of the discussion, just to sort of bring that element a little bit, as much as I could, into it. In a way, in the end, you have to face that fear, but you need strong accompaniment for that, if you see what I mean. You need to find the right time to do it. Anything else? I don't know whether this is all helpful, but this is what we're going to try and explore. Anything else that you need to know in order to do that?
Just slightly, a bit unclear. So in the practice, normally we do, you know, we get in touch with the contact with the element and say, this isn't me, this isn't mine. You were suggesting that we actually go out to almost like look for self?
Yes.
Is it the other?
Yeah.
You're actually looking for self.
Yes. What you're doing in the practice, as we learnt it from Bhante, is you're recognising the impermanence and dependence of that element, aren't
yes.
you?
Yes.
That you're deliberately doing that, and its lack of specialness. Because, of course, what goes with being I, and we'll see when we get to the Sahaja Kleshas, is Atmamana, pride in I. We think we are unique. You know, like my mum used to. For a little while. And we want to perpetuate that. And we really believe in the end that we are. So you're trying to undermine that. Through recognizing that the earth element of me is just the earth element outside, you know, Bhante is turning into the earth element right now, and I'm going to do that too in one way or another, and you know the elements that are in me came from out there. So you're without spelling it out, you're seeing through, and you could employ those in the exercise of the analytic that I'm suggesting. But I find it quite helpful. I'm just going to ask you, can you find anything permanent? If you can, you may not be able to focus enough to do it, but you go, just have a look around. The illustration I always give in India is of being frightened of ghosts when I was a child. In India, they love this because everybody's terrified of ghosts. I lived in a big house at the top, and I was the youngest, so I went to bed earliest. And I'd go up to my room, and I'd become convinced there were ghosts. I don't know where I learned about them, but I was convinced there were ghosts. So I'd shout to my father, he'd come up, and he was very, very clever. He didn't just say, oh, there are no ghosts. He said, okay, where are they? Under the bed. So he, you know, say, okay, come on. We'd look under the bed, no ghosts. And then say, in the cupboard. So we'd look in the cupboard and behind the door and so on. And eventually, you know, I'd got nowhere else to find ghosts. So he'd go away. All the ghosts came back then, but that's another story. And in fact, that's part of the problem now, isn't it? So it's the equivalent of that, that you're going looking for the ghost of self. What is it? The ghost in the machine. Anybody study philosophy? Gilbert Ryle, the ghost in the machine. So you go looking for a permanent self. Because if you're to disprove the existence of something, in a way you've got to, something that doesn't exist, ultimately, you've got to go looking for it. So you look for its characteristics. And when you cannot find anything that has those characteristics, the sense of conviction that this is a black light or whatever, a dark light, you know what I mean? It's something that is can't exist. Yeah? Mm. So the practice as we do it, as we conventionally do it, does go about this. But, and it's pretty effective actually, but I wanted to give a sharper analytic edge to it for the purposes of bringing this out and to maybe help us all to deepen that that recognition. See whether it works, may not. Or could
you? I was thinking about the Trikaya you mentioned.
Oh.
And it's got a sense that I might be able to do the practice better the more I was connected to, I guess, being feeling devotional. Or,
oh.
So I don't know if that's true or not. Or if so, how might I do that?
Oh. Well, I think it's undoubtedly true that when you're doing, talking about all this, there needs to be some sense of what transcends views. So there needs to be some sense of what transcends self. If you go into it without some more than sense, but some connection with that, you're inevitably going to take it as nihilistic. So how might you do it in this practice, what you mean, or in general, in this practice?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what's occurring to me is maybe we should start, all of us, by just invoking our Yidam and doing the practice in their presence. Let's experiment with that, just sort of setting up the Buddha or Bodhisattva before you. If you do a visualization within, it's a little bit more complicated because you're dissolving, anyway, an I that's not you. But in order to do that, of course, that visualization within is already a six-element practice because you're setting yourself aside and identifying with another self, which is a transcendental one. But yet, if we can all try to sort of set that up, Bhante's recommended, for instance, doing practices having the refuge tree in front of you, so that you start from the point of view of faith. So let's take a hint from that, see whether that works. And then if you do feel the ground trembling under your feet, which you should do, you sort of then connect that with, or rather not connect it with, you reflect that in the light of of the Buddha or Bodhisattva, because it's in order to become them that you're giving up this. It's not just giving up this because you don't exist and you're not worth it anyway. It's giving up this so that this can become reality. I like that. I won't introduce choppers and darkies yet.
Thanks.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's helpful, actually. This whole discussion is helpful. So I think nihilism is always a danger for some.
I'd be interested in also exploring outside of the practice as well, and maybe not.
Developing faith outside the practice. Well, to me, Bhante's last paper is the big clue. Not that it appeal to everybody, but the mantra. That I know different people have different relations to their sadhanas, but I think if you can make the sadhana into the context of your life and live your life in relation to the sadhana, that is the most powerful way, and that you keep the mantra going in the background as much as you can. If you're really serious about developing that sense, it means revising the context of your life. And some of the sadhanas ask you to get up, either carrying the Buddha or Bodhisattva within you, or being the Buddha or Bodhisattva. The Tara practice and the Avalokiteshvara practice, you don't dissolve. You step out from the practice as Avalokiteshvara, as a Tara, trying to identify your mind with Amitabha, your speech with the mantra, and your body with Avalokiteshvara's actions. So I find that a very powerful sort of background to my life. It's not easy to keep it up, but I think rather than just waiting until you can do a puja every now and again, which probably I don't relate to all that strongly, confession time, but sort of trying to make your daily meditation practice, if it is sadhana, be your day. That's the traditional way. Sadhana does not mean merely meditation practice. It's really more like a devotional, meditative life, so that you see your life as a service to the particular Buddha or Bodhisattva, and you try to keep in connection with them, with the pride of the Buddha or Bodhisattva. I am a child of Avalokiteshvara. How can I do this? And again, in that paper, Bhante talks about mantrayana and the importance of mantra, or rather the significance of mantra. He says this doesn't appeal to everybody or appeals to some, but we have been given a very precious gift in those mantras, and I think over the last years maybe we've been, you know, that some have not lost that, but maybe there's been more of an emphasis on Shakyamuni as the basic figure and so on and so forth, but I think there's still a lot that we've got in those sadhanas that we need to bring up. And then I think doing the six element practice, if it's done in the context of your sadhana, is getting yourself out of the way so that you can let the Bodhisattva raise you up to his or her level. More later, no doubt. And of course, the Pure Land, there's an equivalent way of it. It's the same thing, really. It comes out of the same stable. That you live your life in relation to that larger story. I hope that's helpful. These are things that I've been, as I say, exploring in India, where I've had to sort of get outside my own cultural conditioning in order to sort of understand the problems that people have. They just got their problems, we've got our problems, they're not bad, stupid or something like that, they're completely intelligent, but they're different, and that I find very revealing.